Excellent. The next case on our calendar this morning is State of Minnesota versus DeAndre Ramsey. We're ready to hear from counsel for appellant. Please introduce yourself for the record before beginning each leg of your argument.
Good morning. May it please the court, I am Sarah Martin. I represent the appellant, DeAndre Ramsey. Mr. Ramsey challenges his convictions for attempted second-degree murder and possession of a machine gun. We raised four issues in appellant's brief, and Mr. Ramsey raised other issues in his pro se supplemental brief. Today, I'd like to focus on the misconduct issue, including the prosecutor's intentional elicitation of inadmissible testimony identifying Mr. Ramsey as the shooter, and the prosecutor's failure to prevent three experienced law enforcement witnesses prejudicial character evidence that informed the jury that Mr. Ramsey had an arrest record, that he was known to and tracked by law enforcement, that he was a felon, and that he routinely carried a firearm, all of which portrayed Mr. Ramsey as a dangerous criminal. The legitimate evidence in this case was not strong, and without the inadmissible testimony, the state was left with evidence placing Mr. Ramsey in the general vicinity of the shooting and the fact that he possessed the gun several days later. The cumulative impact of the improper testimony deprived Mr. Ramsey of a fair trial. The first issue I'd like to talk about is
Before you do that, and I don't normally ask for a little more on the facts, could you just give me a brief recitation of the facts regarding his in-custody interrogation by the police? What did they ask him, and what did he say about his involvement in the homicide?
He did not say anything verbally. Sergeant Johnson interpreted Mr. Ramsey's kind of nodding along, and I think if you watch the video of the interrogation, you'll see this. He kind of nods when he talked to him. And so she had asked a question. It was a compound question about both the gun and the shooting, and he was nodding along with the question. He did not respond specifically at that point. There were other points during the interrogation where he specifically denied.
And the state argued to the jury that his nodding along was an affirmation or positive response to the questions being asked.
That's correct.
And one of the questions had something to do with, well, and this was the gun that was used in the murder.
It was a compound question about both possessing the gun and using the gun in the shooting.
But the question was specifically his use of the gun in the shooting, not that the gun in general was used in a shooting. What was the question? Do you have it?
Don't have it off the top of my head right now, yes. Okay. Hugh's testimony about the tip that Block Money was the shooter and that Block Money was Ramsey's nickname was improper. Officers may testify that they received a tip to explain actions taken in a particular case. But prosecutors cannot introduce the substance of that tip to law enforcement to explain actions taken during an investigation. This is clearly inadmissible. Case law going back over 40 years prescribes this type of testimony. A number of those cases are cited in the briefs, Litzau and Williams, Cermak. In 1994, the Minnesota Supreme Court said that case law is crystal clear that a police officer testifying in a criminal case may not relate the hearsay statements of others under the guise of explaining how the investigation focused on the defendant. And that's precisely what happened in this case. In Williams, it was plain error to admit testimony that officers received a tip that the defendant was a drug courier and on a train with a particular quantity of crack cocaine. It amounted to plain error in Williams, even though the prosecutor specifically told the jury to consider the testimony only for the purpose of explaining the steps in the investigation. The state in this case argues that it wasn't hearsay because it wasn't admitted for the truth of the matter asserted. But that's not accurate. Even if that was the prosecutor's intent, there was no instruction and no argument to that effect, so the jury likely used it as substantive evidence. In fact, in closing argument, the state appears to use it as substantive evidence. They argued, we got a tip that the name of the shooter was a person named Block Money. That's the defendant's nickname. And the state had actually prefaced that by saying, Nicole Hughes, she's an intelligence expert. She gathers information from law enforcement all over the country. She is a person who is paid to know things. That is her job. So not only telling the jury to rely on it, but this is why you should rely on it. This is why her testimony is reliable. The error in this case was prejudicial. It went to the only contested issue at trial, which was the identity of the shooter. Without this testimony that Block Money is Ramsey and Block Money is the shooter, the jury might have questioned whether the grainy video established that Mr. Ramsey was the shooter. The prosecutor also committed misconduct by failing to prepare its three primary witnesses, all of whom were experienced law enforcement officers, and that led to them blurting out inadmissible character evidence.
Counsel, going back to that previous statement, mm-hmm. It's clear that the issue here is the identity of Block Money, who that is. Outside of Officer Hughes or Investigator Hughes' statement, don't we also have the video from Augie's that, from my viewing, is fairly clear in the use of tattoos and other identification methods to identify Mr. Ramsey as the individual who was there, who was wearing the blue hat and the white shirt?
The video from Augie's is the only clear video in the case. And yes, so I do believe that it established that the jury could look at Mr. Ramsey and determine that that was him. And
how does that play into the analysis as to whether or not his substantial rights was violated, if that was one factor in kind of the identification of Mr. Ramsey, given that the identification seems to me to be the key to this case? Who is this individual in the white shirt, blue hat?
Again, I believe that it establishes that he was at Augie's. Like, the jury could reasonably find that he was present at Augie's. I don't believe, if you watch the surveillance video, the milestone video that was captured in Exhibit 15 that Sergeant Johnson testified to, I don't think that shows the person in the blue hat and white shirt committing the shooting, at least not clearly. That video is extremely grainy, and I think from all of the stills that were shown, it does not establish that he was the person that committed the shooting. It merely establishes that he was in the general vicinity at the time.
And is that the video that, is that the one you're referring to that is showing out in front of what I believe is Augie's? There's folks congregating. The video zooms in, individual with the white shirt walks behind the victim. There's a muzzle flash and then folks running. Is that the video? I thought that was 41, but you're saying that's Exhibit 15?
I think Exhibit 15, videos came in, I think, under several different exhibits. Exhibit 15, I believe, is Sergeant Johnson going through the video and pointing out the stills. I believe that's her PowerPoint. Okay. And then Exhibit 42 is the actual video. That's
okay.
Correct.
Thank you.
The prosecutor also committed misconduct by failing to prepare its three primary witnesses. Hughes testified that she received a photo from the Minnesota Repository of Arrest Photos and information from the St. Paul Police Department. Hughes also testified that investigators keep track of nicknames and monikers of people that they're tracking with trends, which is how they knew that Ramsey went by the name Block. Sergeant Johnson testified that finding the Glock brand magazine in Ramsey's car was evidence that he had a history of possessing the gun. And Special Agent Carpenter testified that Ramsey had an active felony warrant in Minnesota and that he was a felon who was commonly in possession of a firearm. The prosecutor and the court at trial agreed that this testimony was improper. The prosecutor argued against mistrial motions, however, because they did not intentionally elicit any of that testimony.
Can I ask a question about our role? With respect to the history of possessing the gun, I know that word history was used, when I just read the transcript, just myself, I look at it's like, well, they found that the gun in, they found the gun, was it in his car? I'm sorry if I forgot, right? They found the gun in the car. What does that mean? And then wanted the, them to spell it out. Well, it meant that was the weapon that was shot, and he had a history of possessing it. When that history is a funny choice. I mean, basically, he had the weapon that was shot. You know, that's how I read. And then there was an objection, and then it's like, well, depending on, you know, people didn't quite recall. And the state didn't characterize it as, oh, that's a mistake because it said a past history. I mean, the state, I don't see the state conceding that exactly. But I'm wondering, what do we owe any deference to any sort of reading of that by the district court or by the state's concession, or do we read it?
I think that this court can read it. And the trial court didn't make any specific finding about how that is interpreted. I think that the history of possessing the firearm is more problematic, too, when it's combined with Agent Carpenter's testimony that Mr. Ramsey had an active felony warrant in Minnesota and that he was a felon who was commonly in possession of a firearm, especially when you take those two statements together. It suggests more than just going back a few days to September 17th.
Was the felony warrant the warrant to arrest for this case?
The active felony warrant, that was not clear from the transcripts, what he was talking about. But it also said that he was a felon who was commonly in possession of a firearm. So if he is a felon, that implies that he has a felony conviction. All of this information taken together prejudiced the defense. It suggested that the police knew Mr. Ramsey from another case, that he was a dangerous enough offender, that he was on police radar, that officers were tracking him, and that he routinely carried a firearm. Altogether, it painted Ramsey as a dangerous criminal. The curative instructions, which was to disregard Mr. Ramsey's arrest history or alleged possession of a firearm prior to September 17th, was not sufficient to remedy the harm, as the defense argued. If there had been a single instance of improper testimony, perhaps it would have been enough. But in this case, it's three witnesses, three primary witnesses. They are law enforcement witnesses, and the jury gives their testimony great weight. And then even if that instruction had been sufficient to remedy the harm in this case, the prosecutor showing the booking photo in closing argument really brings all of that to the forefront again, and there was no instruction given to the jury after that. In all of the Spriegel cases, there is concern that jurors will rely on other bad acts testimony for an improper purpose, and that is likely what happened here. Considering all of the factors that this court looks to determine whether misconduct is prejudicial, we look to the pervasiveness. Does it happen more than once? We look to the strength of the case. In this case, there's no motive evidence. There's no eyewitness testimony. KM does not say at the scene, or and he doesn't come in and testify. No one identifies Mr. Ramsey. And there's no confession in this case. So the state's case is not strong. And then all of the misconduct in this case went to the one contested issue at trial, which is the identity of the shooter. For all of the reasons stated in appellant's brief, Mr. Ramsey asks this court to reverse his convictions. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now hear from counsel for the state. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and opposing counsel. My name is Robert Yount, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota in today's matter. Now, appellant's flagship argument is at base a cumulative error claim. that there were cumulative errors throughout the trial that significantly impacted the jury verdict. So I want to start with the strength of the evidence in this case. Following the September 17th, 2022 shooting, officials pulled surveillance footage from the area. They were able to see the incident happen from the footage. It was an individual, an African-American male, wearing a blue hat, a white t-shirt, and gray pants. They then received a tip that the shooter went by the name or street name Block or Block Money. That didn't mean anything to them immediately, so they had to cross-reference that with their internal database. Well, that pinged a DeAndre Ramsey. They then took that name and cross-referenced it against a statewide database of prior arrest photos. Well, that pinged a mugshot of a previous mugshot from Mr. Ramsey. They then took that mugshot and compared it to the surveillance footage, now having the benefit of having a suspect in mind. And lo and behold, at 1:15 in the morning, walking into Augie's wearing a blue hat, a white t-shirt, and gray pants was Mr. Ramsey. He was with known associates at the period of time that they were known to law enforcement. And then in consulting the milestone surveillance, they were able to trace their steps leading into Augie's and after. So what they saw is that they parked at an adjacent parking lot, again, in a vehicle known to law enforcement. And then after Augie's, they went back to that vehicle at approximately 2:15 or 2:20 in the morning and then came back to the area from that parking lot. Now, the relevancy of going back to the vehicle after Augie's is that Augie's has metal detectors. An individual cannot carry a firearm into the cabaret. In the experience of the officers that they testified to at trial, that is what they've seen individuals who carry firearms do at night or in the early morning. And then the surveillance footage shows, this is Jury Exhibit 4 from Camera 40, addressing Judge Harris's question, is that it shows the incident, shows the individual, the African-American male, wearing the blue hat, the white t-shirt, the gray pants, i.e. DeAndre Ramsey, shoot the victim 7 times, point blank. In addition to that, 5 days later, when officials arrested Mr. Ramsey, not only did he have the weapon on his person, the testimony established that when they approached him and handcuffed him, he said, it's in here," and nodded to his own backpack.
So, counsel, you're outlining the strength of the evidence, and I think that's one factor in assessing whether error is harmless, but really the key factor is whether or not the error substantially influenced the verdict. And in this case, you have 3 separate occasions where officers, experienced officers, testified to the fact he was a felon, the fact that he had a history of possessing weapons, the fact that he had active warrants and was a felon who commonly was in the possession of firearms. 2 of the times, the court specifically said this is improper and was very concerned. The court then crafts a curative instruction, reads the curative instruction, and then after that, the state then shows a mugshot that I understand the state says it's cropped and it may not be a mugshot, but it's a mugshot. How does that not affect or influence the verdict? Not just the strength of the evidence, but that cumulatively, it seems to me it's almost like the baseball reference. It's the 3rd, 4th strike here. How should this court analyze that given that kind of route of how the evidence came in?
I'll respond to that by saying that the identified statements that appellant props up are not nearly as inflammatory as appellant makes it seem when taking them out of context. And I'll go back to Judge Smith's point, is that when you read those comments in the context of the testimony, they are not prejudicial and they are not inflammatory. And so I'll start at the top.
So 2 of the statements, the court said they were improper. For example, in context, question, in the 3rd week of September, near September 17th to 21st, were you brought in to investigate a man named DeAndre Ramsey? Yes, ma'am, and how so? We were informed Mr. Ramsey had an active felony. I don't think that's fairly inflammatory, but moving on, through the state of Minnesota, and that he was a felon that was commonly in possession of firearms. Given that this is a firearms case, how is that, in that context, not inflammatory that he had an active felony warrant and he's commonly in possession of firearms?
And I want to respond to that by digging into exactly what he was testifying about. This is ATF Carpenter on page 416 of the transcript.
That's correct.
they were asking him what was his understanding about the warrant that was issued based on the shooting. So we have a felony level offense of attempted murder involving a gun where law enforcement believed that the shooter would continue to have the gun because they didn't recover the gun. So this is ATF Carpenter explaining that this was a felony level warrant for an individual in possession of a firearm. The fact that he used the phrase commonly in possession, quite frankly, I think that's cop talk. I think that's an officer who's used to that standard language. He wasn't talking about the history that he, for example, had prior offenses related to firearms. None of that came in. ATF Carpenter was only testifying to the fact that there was a warrant issued for his arrest involving a firearm and that he was assumed to be in possession of a firearm. That's what the state argued below, and in fact, I would point to the district court's comment saying that that was only unambiguous interpretation that there was a history of possessing firearms. So at most, what you're dealing with is maybe a poor choice of words with the use of the word common, but that doesn't rise to the level of inflammatory prejudicial misconduct. Moreover, the court is quite clear, and I don't think defense counsel below even challenged this, that wasn't intentionally solicited or elicited by the prosecutor. All of the questions that, you know, were, that that led up to the testimony in question were they were not improper questions. I want to focus on that because when you're dealing with claims of prosecutorial misconduct on appeal, there's two tiers of review. There's a more deferential and less deferential one. And when you're dealing with non-intentional claims of misconduct, which is what we have here, it's more deferential to the substance that comes in through those witnesses.
Counsel, could you, I guess I have to ask, you know, we have several concerns about, or several concerns are raised about statements that were made by the law enforcement witnesses, and I think even the district court was quite clear that the judge was not happy with this information coming in and that the prosecution had not taken the steps it should have to prepare its witnesses. Why shouldn't we be concerned that that information impacted the jury's decision in this case? Because I think the Supreme Court just explained on yesterday, it's not just, well, was there enough evidence to secure a conviction? We have to be asking, did the allegedly improper evidence influence the jury in a prejudicial way? That is, cause the scale to tip in the state's favor.
I'll respond directly to your last point about the recent Supreme Court decision. I believe that's Little Bear. I could be wrong in the name. The reason why I did not cite that as supplemental authority is because my understanding is that was on a straight evidentiary challenge to the evidence introduced. Appellant has chosen to challenge all of these through the lens of prosecutorial misconduct about whether they were prepared or not. So I think that the analysis there is guiding, but it's not exactly on point to this case. We have to look at the deferential standards of review for prosecutorial misconduct. Now, going to the substance of what your question is why shouldn't we be concerned?
I mean, because ultimately, if it's cumulative error at the end of the day, we're saying, well, was this a fair trial or were rights impacted in a way that was unfair?
And I want to address the substance of your question, but you just bring up an important point here, which is remember, we are really at base dealing with a cumulative error, and those are quote unquote rare cases. That's the language that the courts use, is that when you're picking apart individual evidentiary or testimonial statements and you're saying that they're cumulatively impact the trial, that's a very high standard to clear. And now going back to what...
Right.
So if you take each of those statements in part, they really address specific steps taken in the criminal investigation, and they do not go to what is, I think Judge Harris pointed out accurately, the most important and critical and incriminating piece of evidence, which is the surveillance footage. That's separate. That's not really impacted by any of these specific lines of testimony. So, for example, you have
isn't it impacted in that the key part of that video is who is the individual in the blue hat, white shirt, and getting to from point A of we don't have a suspect to who that individual is, all of these statements are important in identifying Mr. Ramsey as a suspect and ultimately being able to point to the jury to say, there is a video showing the shooting, that is the individual in the blue and white hat, and it's Mr. Ramsey. Isn't that all play into this?
I think the way you just put it is, I want to emphasize it because I think it's right, is that all of these allegedly improper statements that the witnesses made go to the steps that led law enforcement to find that he was a suspect. These are not inflammatory statements that said, oh, he did it, or I had received a call from someone saying that he was the shooter. They're all one step removed from the guilt of the defendant here. They're statements such as, I consulted a repository of arrest photos and received a mugshot. There's no identifying information about when or where, what jurisdiction, what crime, what conviction, what sentence. None of that inflammatory information came in with that statement. It was just a witness saying, we received an arrest photo. And when they showed the unobjected to arrest photo at trial, I mean, it's an official photo. And so while it was improper, I agree with Judge Larkin's point, is that the judge said below, that's improper, but the judge also found that it was not prejudicial.
So, I mean, as I see it, I think, is whether that's Mr. Ramsey in the surveillance video is proved otherwise, apart from that testimony, right? That is he who's in the video.
Yes.
And so whatever was said about it, so the identity is, like, independently proved is your point, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so, and I don't know that that's actually challenged, whether that's he in the video. But who is the shooter is the question, yes. Right? And with respect to the tip, when a tip said, it wasn't just there was a tip that led us to look at, but the tip is not only is he black and blah, 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 because you could independently show that and that's him, but that's the person who actually shot. Why doesn't that cause substantial prejudice?
For two reasons. Well, I should say one reason, but that it's twice removed. So, for example, the tip was that the shooter went by a street name. When law enforcement received that, they didn't know who that was. They had to look and see if they had anyone in their database that went by that street name. They came up with a DeAndre Ramsey. So, for example, in the State v. Litzau decision, right, where this court noted that that was an improper testimony relaying of a tip, the tip in that case was the defendant's going to be here and he's got drugs. And it went to a critical element in that case. This is one step removed because it wasn't even a tip saying that DeAndre Ramsey was the shooter. It was that someone with the street name was a shooter. And then...
Well, someone with a street name Black, which they later figure out. I mean,
right.
By the time you're at trial, you know he's Black, right? There's
right.
not really an issue.
But that's the point, is that it was one minor step in the initial investigation that led to much more substantial, much more incriminating evidence, i.e. the surveillance footage.
Right, but the trial testimony could have been, we got a tip that led us to, without describing that the tip was he's the shooter. Maybe it's like implicit that that's what the tip is doing, but you know what, I'm just looking at what Litzau says and what you're supposed to do, that you could just neutralize the tip and get in, you know, he's who you have. Because what you wanted to do was show that the person on the, he's Ramsey and this is the person on, mm-hmm. that's the person who's on the video, right? And the video proves it. That's your case, right?
Yes. And, you know, I want to go back to what the prior cases have recognized about why do we allow officers to convey tips? You know, not the substance or incriminating or, you know, dangerous or damaging things of tips, but why do we allow officers to convey it? Because we don't want them to make it seem like it's a capricious or arbitrary investigation. Mm-hmm. You need to show the jury steps about why they ended up zeroing in on an individual person. And in this case, the fact that he went by Black Money wasn't even offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted. I know appellant takes issue with that, but it just simply wasn't. There was no evidence, there was no person, you know, on the street called to identify Ramsey that he goes by that nickname. It was offered just as one link in that chain of the criminal investigation. And again, that's entirely independent of what the real incriminating evidence here is that DeAndre Ramsey is seen on crystal clear HD video going into Augie's wearing the blue hat, white t-shirt, gray pants. And then the milestone video, through the testimony of Sergeant Johnson, is able to trace his exact steps, leaving Augie's, returning to the area with the same two or three associates, and then you can see the incident on camera showing the individual wearing that blue hat, that white shirt, those gray jeans.
Counsel, in that same video, there's another individual with a white shirt and gray pants, and blue hats are fairly transferable. So again, isn't the identification key here? And while you have a crystal clear video of him going into Augie's, you have a crystal clear video of him in the lobby of Augie's, you would agree that the shooting video, at least, is not as crystal clear as the Augie's video, and given that that is not as crystal clear, again, going back to, you know, the hearsay statement, the question was, were you able to identify the shooter in this case? And as part of that, he said that DeAndre Ramsey goes by Black Money. Again, how does that not, given the other statements earlier by law enforcement about his propensity to have guns, his propensity to have felonies, in addition with a hearsay statement that he is Block Money and Block Money is the shooter, how does that not substantially affect the verdict in this case?
I see that my time is up.
Please
do you mind if I respond? I'll try to make this as brief as possible, but I want to make one or two points. First of all, I think Your Honor used the term propensity to possess a firearm. I don't want to call Your Honor out, but I think it's important that that is not the testimony here. I think in context,
at least there's a history of possessing a firearm.
And the reason why, I'm saying that is because I would disagree with that. I would go back to Judge Smith's point, which is read in context. They were not talking about his history prior to the shooting. They were only talking about his possession of the firearm following the shooting. I think that the context bears that out. Now, going to Your Honor's point about is the video less clear or more blurry, yes, the milestone footage is more blurry, but I would direct the court's attention to respondent's brief page number 4, because at the timestamp at 2:32:25 a.m., you see the individual with the blue hat step behind the victim, behind a wall, and then at 2:32:46, you see the shooter walk up with the blue hat and shoot the victim. At that same screen, and I believe this is the case, don't hold me to it, I believe you can see the other individual with the white shirt and the gray pants, who's not the shooter at that point in time. And to Your Honor's point.
And I'm sorry to interrupt, but that goes to my point, is there's a blurry video where you have two individuals, and there's not clarity as to which one of those individuals is Mr. Ramsey. The only clarity is that one of them is wearing a blue hat. I guess, given all of this, how is it not prejudicial? I'll strike that. Go ahead and continue.
As Your Honor said, only one of them was wearing a blue hat. DeAndre Ramsey is seen wearing a blue hat all night. The victim was shot in the back. That's not contested. Mm-hmm. So you have only one individual behind the victim on the camera, again, wearing the blue hat. And then the last point I want to make is respond to Your Honor's question, or excuse me, Judge Larkin's question about what was the specific testimony or what was the specific happened during the Scales interview? You asked for what the specific language was. Sergeant Johnson confronted him and said, "We both know that the switch you were caught with was the one used in the shooting." He responded with, "Which shooting?" She then said, "The one at Augie's," and he nods visibly up and down. That was the full statement from that video.
So she didn't ask, and you were the one who did the shooting?
She did not. That was the full scope of it, but...
Understood.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Your time is up. We'll hear rebuttal from Appellant's counsel.
The state appears to be arguing that it was appropriate, all of this evidence comes in appropriately because it was just steps in the investigation. But again, going back to the cases of Litzau, Williams, Cermak, a number of cases cited in the brief, the police officers cannot relay the contents of the tip. They can say simply, "We received a tip. We received a tip, and then we got a warrant. We received a tip, and then we investigated." But they can't convey the substance of the tips. So this was certainly improper testimony. And then as for the remainder of the testimony, this idea that commonly in possession of a firearm and history of possessing a firearm was limited, even if that is one reading, there's no way to know that that's how the jury read it and that or how they interpreted it. And the district court was certainly concerned enough about this to admonish the prosecutors to prepare their witnesses better. And it bears repeating that these are experienced law enforcement witnesses. They should have known better. This isn't the case of a first-time lay witness just being nervous and blurting out some information. The officers in this case should have known better that this was inadmissible. For all of the reasons stated here, I would ask that Mr. Ramsey's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your arguments and briefing. The case is submitted. You'll have our decision within the 90 days required by law.